Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4, for Spring Semester 2020. Lecture 17, delivered on March 30th.
Tonight, Risk and Return. But before we do risk and return, let's have a look at the numbers for the day, as we usually do. Yeah, you could talk to each other too, except I was having people flirting and things like that in other classes, and that was not good. Hang on here. Let me pull up and get the numbers up here. Share the number screen. And there we go. As you can, really? What in the world? Oh, there we go. Okay, now, as you can see, we had another good, strong day. And it was one of those days when you have a strong upsurge on all of the markets. As you will notice, the NASDAQ went up the most. The S&P 500 went up somewhat less, and the Dow went up the least, although they were both above 3%. Again, that is an indication that you have someone. Oh, someone's, that person moving is weirding me out there. You had more strength in the smaller stocks and less strength okay. The larger the companies in the index were. So it, whatever the good news was, it was definitely biased, at least somewhat, toward larger or rather smaller cap companies. And that's not surprising. They're going to be more beneficiaries of the stimulus. Now, if we go over here and we look at the bond market, you can see that the bond market price, the index price, went down. So that's an indication right there that the money was bonds were being sold by investors, and the proceeds were moving back into equities. Now, does this mean that the bad times are over? No, this is probably still the dead cat bounce, and the cat's got a lot of bounce in it. When you push a $2 trillion, but as you can see, the bonds fell in price. That's selling bonds, dropping their price. And then the money used, along with other money, to push into equities. In other words, stocks. That's why the stocks went up. Now, if we go back and see how gold was doing, gold shed money too. So there's definitely a reverse flight to quality. Money is coming out of safer investments, gold, bonds, and it's coming into the riskier investments, equities. How long is that going to last? Well, that's speculative. Some analysts who are very good at this say that this dead cat bounce is going to be gone by the end of the week. And we'll be back to the grim story. How correct are they? I'm not sure we're going to see much more downside action, although we could. We could have some pretty serious down days. But I am of a mind that the worst of it is over, for at least for the time being. And again, if you take higher level courses in finance, like my investments course, I talk a lot about how you can make money in a very bad market, but you have to know finance, you have to be willing to spend the time to do the analysis, and you have to be willing to take some risk. Just to give you an idea, see this over here? And I'm not showing, don't ever follow me on investments. Otherwise, you will become a very old person before your time with the risks that are taken with it. But as you can see, these are all derivatives. They're options. And as you can see of them, I was up very strongly on 6 of my 8. And I lost some tread on 2 of the 8. And so even on a bad day, you can make money. This was a good day, so it was a much better day for a portfolio like mine. where you are not just investing in whatever you feel like or whatever you heard someone say. You're targeting investments very specifically toward stocks, companies that have something that is different from what the market itself has. Taking that off the board here now, and moving back over here to the, as a matter of fact, someone just asked me, can we see the cats today? At the lecture in my investments class 242, they decided one of them wanted out, one of them wanted in, and there was all this meowing. Yes, you will see them. Yeah, hello cats. They're going to be here, I guarantee you. And they're not good at finance. So if I'm not at the Zoom and someone is answering your investment questions, your finance questions, don't believe them. That's one of my cats getting me in trouble by giving bad advice and bad teaching, content. Moving along now. Well, let's go through. So I want to go through bonds just a little bit more before I get into risk and return. In the subject of bonds, one subject, of course, I had already mentioned this before, is that when the coupon is paid on a bond, it is not paid annually. It is actually paid semi-annually. So look at this one right here. Let's do ACS 4.2% 2029s right here. Now this is some company, its ticker symbol is ACS, and it's got a bond out there that pays 4.2% annual coupon. And it's going to live until 2029. This would probably have been a bond that was maybe sold, if it were a 10-year, that would have been, it was issued. The company borrowed the money in 2019, or maybe it was 2014. That means it would have been, it's some kind of 15-year bond. Or maybe it was in 2009. It would be a 20-year. Or 1999. Yeah, that would be a 30-year bond. But that's actually not relevant at this point. The history of the bond, when it was issued, doesn't matter anymore. All that matters is if you bought this bond in the secondary market, what you would be essentially doing is becoming the buyer of the loan that was made to this ACS company. So now you are going to get the 4.2% coupon every year until 2029. And at that year, 2029, you're going to get one last coupon interest payment, and you're going to get $1,000 because that's what the company borrowed. The company doesn't pay any of that $1,000 during the life of the loan. It pays the face value off all at once at the end. That would be kind of a challenge. If a company borrows $50 million, it doesn't have to pay that $50 million back until the end of the loan. All it has to do is pay the interest, and that could be a very bad thing. So what always happens in the bond indenture, in other words, the agreement between the original lenders and the company, there's a provision. The company has to put money into a fund. Sometimes it's called a sinking fund that gets filled up with the $50 million so that when 2029, in this case, comes around, the company has that money. It can pull out of that fund to pay back the lenders the face value, the principal balance of the loan. It can be different ways. Usually, a company, let's say this company borrowed $10 million, and this was, let's say, originally a 20-year bond. They would probably have set up a sinking fund that would have some millions of dollars, maybe $1.5 million, put into it every year so that well before the bond expires, matures, as we say, in 2029, that face value is all there, ready to give to the whoever holds the bonds. So keep that in mind. You're going to get your money back unless the bond, unless the company defaults and all that. Now, again here, always, always, that coupon, whatever it is there, you need to turn that into a dollar amount so you don't get it confused with the yield, which is a percentage. Now, as I had said before, you will know one of the two following, usually. You will know, suppose in this case, we know that the price right now of this bond is $990.15. In other words, this bond is selling at a discount to par. Par would be 1,000. This one is selling at less. There would be only one reason for that. The market thinks that the 4.2% is not enough interest for the risk of ACS. It was fine when the bond was issued, but something has changed since then. It could be that all interest rates have gone up, so investors are just having a fit about all coupons, or this company could have become somewhat riskier. And now 4.2% isn't enough. So moving through that, we can now find the yield to maturity on the calculator, and for heaven's sakes, do this on the calculator. Don't do it. I understand that the accounting department still uses tables to do a lot of their financial work. We don't do that here. So now let me pull up the share screen and I'm going to pull up the calculator. And we're going to go through this grinder and we're going to say, well, first we turn on the calculator. Try to see it through all these screens and stuff. Let me kill off this twitching thing here. Okay. Let's press that. Okay, so now we're going to turn on the calculator and we're going to go apps, finance, or finance if you come from Decatur. TVM solver. That old animal is always there for us. Now, originally, I was talking about the bond paying its coupon, the company that borrowed the money, paying its interest, its coupon, once every year. So we'll go through it that way first to get the yield to maturity. We're going to say, all right, this bond has 9 years left on it. We call that the term of the bond, how much time is left. Now, you can divide that, well, what month was that? And that's a higher level course than this. All we're going to say is 9 years. So the first thing we're going to do is say 9 is for the M. Then we're going to grind it out. We don't know the I percent. I percent, please write this down. I percent is the yield. I percent, it's a percentage. It's a yield. Don't ever get it confused with a coupon, which is actually a dollar amount in disguise. Now, the price value, right now, that bond is selling for $990.15. Whoops, and I did something right there that I didn't mean to do, my bad. I want to put negative $990.15. Second insert, a negative sign. Don't put a minus either, put a negative. Now the payments, there's your coupon. You take 0.042, the coupon, times the face value, which is always, again, 1,000. I don't need to tell you that. You never have to worry about it. Bonds are denominated in multiples of 1,000. So whatever this company borrowed, it would have been in a multiple of 1,000. And now we go down to the future value. That's the face value. What you get at the end is that $1,000 candy bar at the end of the bond's life. Making sure that everything down the line from there it looks good. One, one, and on end. End. Don't do it the other way. Now we're going to go up, and we're going to find the yield to maturity. We just put it there. And again, don't ever try to clear something and then go down. Just leave whatever numbers are there, and then go back and write over. Alpha, soft. And so we have a yield to maturity of 4.33%. Sure enough, the market is saying that this coupon should pay more than the coupon. That's why it's selling at a discount to par. That's why it's selling at a discount to par. Because the market says, well, 4.2% isn't enough. So you have investors sell these bonds, which pushes the price down until the price becomes equivalent to the desired markets, the market's desired interest rate. As the price is being pushed down, that's making the yield, what you actually get on the bond, go up. Even though you're still getting a 4.2% coupon, you're buying it at less than $1,000, at less than par, so that makes up the difference. Now, let's say that it's a real bond. A real bond is going to, a real bond is going to pay its coupons in two semi-annual installments. So there won't be a single check for $42 in your mailbox every year. It will be every 6 months a check for $21. So the upshot of that is to make semi-annual coupons happen. First of all, your N is not 9 years. It is 9 years times two times a year. Don't hit equals, just go down. Now leave that I percent alone, because the yield to maturity is what we're going to find again, but for a realistic. Now the price will stay the same. That doesn't change. However, your payments are going to be the 4.2%, 0.042, times 1,000 divided by 2. So you're going to get half as much twice as many times. 18, instead of 9 42s, you'll get 18 21s. Now we're going to go back up here, and this is where you can get tripped up on questions in the homework, questions on a quiz, questions on my final exam. We're going to do alpha solve. And it's going to, don't be tempted, oh, it's 2.17%. No, it's not. Because I gave it everything as semi-annual, the yield is going to come out as the semi-annual yield. So in order to fix that, I'm going to have to double that yield. Move the cursor over to the end and just say times 2. Drop it down, and there's your Uncle Bob. The yield to maturity. Now, interestingly, that yield to maturity really didn't move at hardly at all. I mean, the bond doesn't have much life left, but it will change a little bit. The yield to maturity will change a little bit when you go from annual to semi-annual coupons. It's not nothing really big, but it's there. And in this one, it's not even apparent to two decimal places, but it would be. What would make it more apparent? What would make it more apparent is if you were to have like a longer time to maturity, or a higher, a bigger difference between par and the actual price of the bond. Those could drive the thing a little more. Now I'm going to bring up something else here. I had talked about these kinds of problems before. I had talked about bonds, and bonds have all kinds of flavors. There's some really weird stuff out there, and I'll mention those before I go on to the main topic tonight. But one of the things that I did mention was the callable bonds. When a company can call a bond in early. It's due in 2029. Well, there might be a call provision between the years, let's say, 2024 and 2027. The company has the right, but not the obligation, but it has the right to pay off the bond early. Now, The upshot of that would be that probably it would call the bond early if interest rates had fallen, or if it could borrow money at a lower rate. It would pay off the 4.2% coupon bond and then refi at, let's say, 3.8%. That's why it would call. Now, the call provision, if it is in the company's hands, has the effect of making the bond riskier to investors. Again, let's say that this bond is callable from 2024 to 2027. If I am the investor, the lender, the person holding the bond, expecting my coupons every year and the face value at the end, I am expecting to get 4.2% for nine more years. So if interest rates have fallen and this company exercises its call, what that's going to do is make my investment, my expectation, change. I'm not going to get my 4.2% for nine more years. They're going to pay it off probably in 2024. And then I'm stuck out there reinvesting this at a rate lower than what I wanted. If they're refiing, then interest rates have obviously fallen on bonds of this risk class. So now I am kind of burned. Now I can't reinvest except at 3.8%. Because of that, that will make the bond slightly riskier. So we have another thing that we can look at here. It's called yield to call, YTC. And all you do, if someone asks you, okay, what's the yield to call? You go back here, and I'm going to share the screen again with the calculator popped up. And I'm going to say, okay, excuse me. All I do in a case like this is I change the number of years to the first year a call could happen. In this case, 2024 means that this bond could end as soon as 5 years from, 4 years from now. So what I do is I go back up here and say, really, I kind of am wondering if this bond could actually...
You know, it's all over the news.
The keyboard froze up there. 4 years. So now, semi-annual coupons, the realistic way, 4 times 2 payments a year. And then I'm going to run down here and say, well, actually, everything else is the same. Everything else on this bond is the same. So now I'm going to go up here and do the alpha solve on the yield again, this time, assuming that the bond will be called in 4 short years. Alpha solve, boom. Now remember, this is a semi-annual yield. So I'll have to run over it here to the end and times it by 2 times 2 to get the annual. Oh, look at that. The yield to call is 4.47%. So I can now say, well, 4.4, in other words, market expects quite a bit more because this bond has that call risk in it to the lenders. It's just like in a home loan. Most home loans have some kind of a provision where you can refinance, but that refi option comes at a somewhat higher mortgage rate, APR on your mortgage, especially if you can refi very quickly. Another way that lenders punish borrowers for refi is they'll charge them points extra. Okay, you want to refi? You can do that, but if you refi, we're going to charge you some extra money that's a percentage of what you still owe. So, and that extra kind of goes down as time goes along. But there are different ways that lenders in consumer loans can capture that extra risk they face with the call provision. With corporate bonds, all it means is that the corporate bond is going to have a higher yield to maturity if there's a call provision in it. That's about all there is to that. Now, one last thing, just to get this on the, just to get this off the table before I go on with tonight's lecture. On the subject of bonds, there are all kinds of different bonds out there in terms of how long they are. You got the 10-year, 15, 20, 30. You've even got 50-year bonds. Heck, you've even got bonds that are really long. There's, in fact, a legendary story about a bond that was issued by the French government back when it was a very different animal. This bond actually has no maturity. It goes on forever. The interest payments just keep being paid. That, I think it was during the Napoleonic era, it was issued. And the family still, the family that originally lent Napoleon's government the money, they're still around. And they insist they get their coupon every year or every 6 months or what, however it is. Okay, so there's that. Now, there's other kinds of bonds, too. One kind of bond that's kind of that's sort of interesting, and you'll see it out there, are bonds that pay off in something other than money. Famous stories about the gold bonds from World War II. After World War II, our government wanted to raise money so that we could go over and rebuild Europe. We bombed the hell out of it. The Nazis had bombed the hell out of parts of it. The Russians had. We'd all torn up the country terribly. There was a movie a few years back called Museum Men, and it gave you sort of a glimpse of right after the war what an absolute mess everything was everywhere. Well, we developed what was called the Marshall Plan. We were going to go over there and rebuild that. America, the leader of the free world, the shining beacon of light and all that. Well, we were going to go over there and rebuild. So we borrowed a whole shoot ton of money to do it. The government issued bonds, government bonds. But it didn't have the payoff. The face value was not in dollars. It was in ounces of gold. Literally ounces of gold was the payoff. And that turned out to be a really bad idea because it turned out that the buyers of these bonds, in other words, the lenders to our government, were many of them old, rich European families. They were lending us money so that we could rebuild their countries. And so when the bonds came due, these old, very rich families collected their payoff, their face value in ounces of gold. It was so bad that they almost literally wiped out Fort Knox, calling in, we had to pay off in ounces, not in value of those ounces, mind you, but in the ounces themselves. So there you have it. That was not a good idea. But there's still our commodity bonds out there. Another one that I will bring up just briefly are what are called foreign bonds. Now, a foreign bond is any bond that pays its coupons and its face value in another currency other than the currency of that country. So... Let me give you a real example. I've mentioned before, I teach in the summers in Central America. In Panama, Panama is a country that is kind of on the move. And they need a lot of money to build their country, make it get closer and closer to a first world country. I mean, when I'm down there, in a given week, I'll see a couple of skyscrapers go up. It's that staggering, the amount of capital that is pouring in there and rebuilding the Panama Canal, expanding insanely their international airport, and cleaning up all of these ancient poor neighborhoods in Panama City and in some of the other cities in the country. All of this requires a huge, I mean, a staggering amount of capital. So Panama has an interesting thing. When you go down there, they have their own currency, but they are very happy to take American dollars. I mean, I'll go into a Wendy's, yes, or a Carl's or a Subway, and they'll just take American dollars. They're just happy to. I go to I usually don't eat at those places. I just go to the grocery stores, these little tiny grocery stores or like a supermarket, and I buy my food and take it back to my hotel to fix. I just pay in American dollars. They're happy to take them. So interestingly, when they issued just an insane amount of bonds, I'm thinking it was like, well, there was one issue that was $775 million, and there have been issues for over $1 billion. They denominate them in American dollars. They're foreign bonds. They pay off in American currency. And of course, that makes the confidence in those bonds very high. Now, who's buying those bonds? Who's lending Panama that money? Well, the Chinese are, the Russians are, the Saudis are. Essentially, those countries are taking control of Panama. And also, of course, that would mean that they are getting their hands on the Panama Canal. As we walk away from our international relationships and we say we have to have me time, the cost of that is that we lose our authority over, our control of the rest of the world. And so they go the way that is desired by their new friends, and we can exert control over their health. Back, I think, before your time, we got tired of the dictator they had, so we accused them of drug trafficking and invaded the country. We can still do things like that. Probably we wouldn't do it now, though, because that would really tick off the Chinese, the Russians, the Saudis. So essentially, our hands are being tied by this. Countries that begin to denominate, and there are actually companies that denominate in euros that are not even in the European Union, but they promise they'll pay in euros. So these are foreign bonds, and pretty popular. As a matter of fact, interestingly enough, some years back when I was doing consulting work, they agreed at the end of the contract I had with this company that I would be paid in euros. And essentially, that was, in other words, they were issuing me a foreign bond that I could call at the end of the project that I was doing for the company. So there's the foreign bond. Kind of an interesting little animal. One last thing. Bonds of different maturities have, how should I put it, clientele. Now, if you're talking about who buys bonds, well, a lot of different animals buy bonds. Recently, even our government is buying them just to have an excuse to throw money into the economy. But traditionally, bonds have been bought by, especially they're bought by trust funds, insurance companies that want safe investments. Bonds are not exciting. They don't move up and down violently. They do move, and keep this in mind, when you're talking about bonds, there is price risk, but it's not really all that much. You know, wow, that bond moved from 1,000 down to 990. Whoa, that was a big ride. Well, my stock went from $5 up to $15. Well, that was a more exciting ride. So bonds are safer investments. So that means that they would be the investments of choice for people, companies, trust funds, retirement funds that wanted to preserve capital. They didn't want to put the money at serious risk. And in fact, they'll even, a lot of these investment sources that buy bonds specifically say no bond below the grade of double A can be bought. They even tighten it more. No junk bonds, not even a bond of double, of single A, all that kind of stuff. So they're very popular. But now the investment in these very long bonds, let's start with a 30-year bond. Well, who would invest in a 30-year bond? I mean, it just pays fixed income for 30 years, and then at the end of 30 years, you get your $1,000 or a multiple of that back. Well, of course, that would be good for retirement accounts because as you're getting, you wouldn't want that money for a long time. But when you retired, then there'd be your money coming out and paying you off, and then you could put it into safe investments through your life as a retiree. Insurance companies don't want, life insurance companies don't want their money back. They just want to put it someplace where it's safe, and they'll get a little stream of coupons over 30, 40 years, 50 years, because the life expectancy of the insureds, their clients, is long enough that they don't want the money back until there's a good probability that the client is going to die and they have to pay off the life insurance. Now, what about these insanely long bonds, 100, 200 year? Who in the world would invest in those? Well, insurance companies might. Because you see, there are some events. They have an extraordinarily low frequency of some disaster, but the severity is ridiculously high. Here in our part of the country, for example, this is a for example. Most people, people might have heard of it, but they aren't aware of how serious it can get. We are not too far from a major fault. It's called fault line. It's called the New Madrid. The New Madrid doesn't break and cause any major earthquake for hundreds of years at a time. But boy, when it does, it is just staggering. As a matter of fact, the last one where the New Madrid broke and tore up, it was in the early 1800s. And I was reading some of the letters from the people who survived the earthquake. It was like reading something out of a science fiction apocalypse movie. They were talking about the entire city was burning. There were dead bodies everywhere. And then there were more earthquakes and more aftershocks. And then the aftershocks became another major earthquake. It was so serious in one of these blowouts of the New Madrid that the story was that the Mississippi ran backwards. That's not exactly what happened. The throw of the earth in the earthquake was so violent that it moved, took the water of the Mississippi, and it heaved it back north. And then it came back south as a tidal wave, flooding all the farmlands along the way around, you know, right around where we are. The Illinois River got just, and it, and then, of course, that, well, I guess that put out the fires, but so there's that. But other than that, it was just absolutely incredible, the level of disaster. Think about that happening now. It's very unlikely in any given year, but it's highly likely over hundreds of years. I had an insurance analyst, an actuary, speak to my students, my finance club students, of a year or 2 years ago. And he came in and he was showing earthquake insurance for businesses out here. And he was showing, well, you know, here's how the premium, the probability that it will happen during this year, times the expected level of damage to the business. And it was showing the table from 2000 up to 2018, it was. And oddly enough, those probabilities were really small, like 0.004%. But every year, it was going up just a little tiny bit. As more time passed since the last earthquake, the higher the probability of another one. Still very small, but again, that's why you would have insurance companies buying that kind of insurance that would be for very long periods. You would not want the money back. You would not want the principal back, the face value. But you would want it back someday, many, many, many years, perhaps centuries in the future. So that's another little side story about bonds, who buys them, and for what purposes. An aggressive investor probably is not going to be too interested in bonds. I look at bonds only so that I can talk about what's going on. Sometimes they give you a window on what interest rates are going to do. Like, for example, if you had a 20-year AAA corporate bond and you had a 20-year government treasury bond, the government treasury bond would have a slightly lower yield than the AAA corporate bond. That difference in those is what we call the credit risk premium or the credit risk. And that should be small. And we watch to see if that begins to open up any at all. That would tell us that there is more risk being assessed in corporate ability to pay than there was, so 2 years ago. The credit risk premium might be, let's say, 40 basis points. Now, a basis point is a 1/100th of a percent. So if there's 40 basis points of difference, let's say that the government bond pays 2% and the AAA corporate pays 2.4%, then that'd be a 40-point credit risk premium on the corporate bond. If that begins to spread out more, well, that would begin to tell me that there is slightly more defaults, because they're both 20 years, there's no maturity risk, and they're both easily sold, so there's no liquidity premium. So the only thing that could be making those move apart is the default premium on the corporate bond is going up, because the default premium on the government bond won't change. Government's not going to default. Yeah, so there are things that we can do with bonds that tell us things, but for an investor who's aggressive, bonds are not a particularly big thing, unless you're really into taking on junk bonds and hoping that the company will come back from the dead and pay them off. But other than that, that's about the story of the bonds. Now, let me take you on to risk and return. No doubt about it, this is the heart of finance, is understanding the relationship between risk and return. They are those two don't live independently. They are locked together. And in a general sense, the greater the risk, the greater the expected return. Rationally, you don't take on greater risk unless you expect to get something for taking on that greater risk. Notwithstanding some people who do things and it's just because they're stupid, you know, there are many failed videos. There are even awards called the Darwin Awards for people who've taken risks that killed them, and they did humanity the benefit of taking their genes out of the gene pool by dying before they reproduce. And there are people, you can't possibly be getting anything out of this. But even there, we kind of argue that, yeah, they are expecting something out of this. Popularity, credibility, a moment in the sun, or maybe it's just an adrenaline rush that they get. Those idiots who climb up to the tops of these towers and walk along the tops of bridges. I look at those and I just say, nope. And I turn off that YouTube or whatever it is. But there are people who do these kinds of things. They take on extraordinary risks, and they're not being paid for it. So, well, there's not a risk-return relationship there. Well, yeah, they are. They're getting something out of it. An adrenaline rush, a popularity thing. I can't tell you. I don't do it, so I don't know what they get out of it. There are people out there who eat. I went to this Indian restaurant, and they had, you could get the spiciness from 0 to 6. And I don't know why I ordered 6. I just don't. I wanted to take a risk. What was I expecting to get out of it? I don't know. All I know is that when they brought it to the table, the guys who were fixing the food in the back were standing there watching me from the doorway. Needless to say, it didn't work out very well at all. My expected return was not anywhere near what I thought what it should have been. And I didn't even... Anyway, we do work on the assumption that there is some reason that a risk is taken. And in finance, we liquidate that reason to a dollar value or to a percentage gain. So if you take on a riskier stock, you do so with the expectation that you're going to get a higher return on your investment. In a case, just speaking personally, I have some wonderful former students. Say one of them wrote to me about a week ago. She said, she just emailed me. She said, so what do you recommend for investments? And I said, I would not do that because I take on insane risks to do what I do. And even I ask myself, why am I doing this? You have to know where your risk tolerance is. And then you move towards that and you get a certain amount of return based upon that risk that you, or you should expect. You could say, well, I'm going to make a whole lot of money off taking this little tiny bit of risk. It ain't going to happen. On the other hand, you can have these fund managers. Well, I made a 28% return on my money last year. And you can too. Baloney. The reality of it is that they made that high return because they took on a lot of risk, perhaps inappropriate risk based upon what kind of clients they had, and perhaps even needless risk. You can take on a whole lot of risk and get a return that you could have gotten taking on less risk. Let me show you something here. When we look at risk and return, now there are a lot of different measures of risk. That's one of the things we'll talk about on Wednesday. How do we measure risk? Well, one way is by standard deviation, the spread of outcomes, of possible outcomes. We have other ways. We can actually, you can talk about, well, in finance, our big one is beta. Beta is kind of related and uses standard deviation, but it fine-tunes it so that beta measures only the risk that can't be removed through portfolio diversification. When you take on a single stock or just a couple of stocks, you are taking on risk that you don't need to take. That risk, that volatility, would go away if you were to put more stocks in your portfolio. So here's how it works. If I say, let's use standard deviation on this axis, and there's a glare on this board that's from hell. And on this axis, I talk about return on the vertical axis. Okay, no big thing there. That's fine. Now, I start looking at different stocks. How much total risk, what we call standalone risk, that the stock had. And okay, we had one stock here that had this much standalone risk, and it got this return. We have this much standalone risk, and we got a lower return. We've literally done this, I don't know, I'd say probably thousands of times. I mean, it's a favorite for
it used to be a favorite for master's theses and doctoral dissertations, plotting a whole bunch of single stocks and small portfolios of stocks, their risk, their spread of possible returns against how much was made on them. And you get this very curious, over and over again, the same odd pattern emerges. These are different stocks or small two or three portfolio stock portfolios. And something emerges.
And we know this. We've seen this in physics, in chemistry, in the hard sciences, in astronomy, astrophysics, in human performance, in mechanical engineering. We see the same odd thing that no matter how many points you plot, there's a white dead space above where you never see one point. And you can actually draw a boundary. In mathematics, what we are seeing here is called, that boundary is called an envelope. Matter of fact, in the 90s, there was this big yuppie saying, well, I'm pushing the envelope. And most of them thought it had to do with pushing an envelope across the table. No, it came from hard science and math, pushing up against this envelope. We see this in stocks. No matter how many you plot, with standalone risk on this axis and return on that axis, they are always inside of this boundary right here. We have a name for that boundary, that envelope. And as a matter of fact, we see this envelope no matter how much you fine-tune a specific engine of a car. There's only so much speed that you can get out of that car. No matter how much a human trains, there's only so much speed or so much lifting weight that can ever be attained. The Guinness Book of World Records kind of shows pushing that envelope in different ways. No matter how there are so many different examples of it. It's just kind of like almost redundant. But anyway, in finance, this boundary here, we call that boundary the frontier of efficient investments. Because right on the boundary would be as good as you could do. I can take, to get this return, I can do no better than this risk. If I want this risk, I can get no better than this return, ever, anywhere. Now, most stocks lie inside of the boundary. Most stocks lie inside of the boundary. Like, for example, look at this might be, let's say, this might be Microsoft. This is actually not too far from where Microsoft would be. Now, if I look down here, I see something interesting. See this risk level, this standalone risk of MSFT. That's its standalone risk as a single stock in a portfolio. But I know that there are, and this is the return you get from Microsoft over here, the return from MSFT. But I know for a fact that there should be portfolios or other stocks clear up to the efficient frontier that for the same risk, you could get a higher return. Most stocks lie within the frontier, lie way deep inside of the frontier on their own. The only way that you can get closer and closer to the frontier boundary is to get more and more stocks in your portfolio. They will cancel out a certain piece of the risk, of the overall total risk involved.
It's the same thing that happens in any kind of a situation where the more you put into it, like the more people you have singing in a choir, the smoother the choir is, the less there's this jiggling and screeching and all that. When you listen to, when we insure people, the more people you put into an insurance pool that you insure, the more they cancel out each other's individual risks, and all that remains is this fairly predictable risk of the population. That's why it's ridiculous for these companies that are cherry pickers, because they avoid people of certain races or certain types of lifestyles. They're stupid, because just adding more people, slowly but surely, they cancel out each other's noise, and all that's left is an underlying hum of the risk of the pool itself. Have you ever seen a bird flying in there? But then you see these birds in flight in these flocks, and you see them doing these beautiful, magnificent moves. It's just awesome. The same is true when I, in my other life as an artist, I took children down to the St. Louis Museum, and I showed this one girl, she was standing right up next to this impressionist painting. And I said, it's kind of messy, isn't it? And she was looking right at this little tiny piece. I said, you got to stand back here, about 15 feet away. Suddenly, it's a beautiful work of art. You see, the noise at the tiny level became the art at the larger level. This is the same thing that's happening in finance here. The more we put in, the more efficient we get. Now, looking at the other way, look at Microsoft. You see, to get that same return, an efficient portfolio could be formed with a lot less risk. In fact, you see this difference between the risk of the individual stock and the risk of a portfolio that could do the same thing on return? That piece of unnecessary risk here, we call it diversifiable risk, because you can get rid of it. And you should not expect any return for taking on that risk. It's stupid risk. Markets don't reward stupid. TV shows do sometimes, YouTube does sometimes, but markets don't. So if you don't want to be punished with risk that you don't need to take, then diversify your portfolio. You can get the same return, but with a lower risk level. And we'll get into that more in detail with a little bit of math, nothing really killer. Thank heaven for calculators and Excel. But that's all I have for you tonight. I thank you.